This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to David Arditi about getting signed, record contracts, musicians, and power in society. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Congratulations on writing this incredibly interesting book, which is kind of like part critical theory book, part ethnography, part almost kind of like policy intervention. It's absolutely fascinating. And I was delighted when you said you'd be up for the interview, partially because it's a good book, but also I think it's a book that speaks, you know, really kind of immediately to where cultural production is, particularly some of the later parts of the book that think about the kind of the process of, as the book is called, getting signed. And the place to start with it, I guess, is what is the book kind of talking about? Which sounds like a daft question, but one of the things that struck me is that record contracts are sort of unique and weird in their own sort of way. And it'd be great to know a bit about sort of what a record contract is. And I guess the kind of the problems of record contracts that got you to write the book.
Yeah, well, record contracts, and I think that this speaks to a broader way that the gig economy today operates. So, if you will, music is the original gig economy workers in kind of contemporary capitalism. So the record contract is something that musicians sign with record labels, usually major record labels, and it stipulates a series of things that responsibilities that both the musician and the label are going to take as part of the contract. And the basic idea is once a musician signs it, they're agreeing to solely produce music for that record label. And in exchange, what they get is an advance. Now, it's not just as simple as they're exchanging to exclusively do this thing with the record label for an advance, but they're also signing away the majority of their copyrights to that record contract or the record label. And what an advance is it's a pot of money that the label or that the artist receives and that they can then produce an album with. So generally, you know, if this were back in the 1990s, this is the easiest way to think about it. I'm going to talk in American US dollars. But if a record label was to sign a new artist, they might sign them for $500,000. The artist needs to pay back that $500,000 on their royalties from the sale of that album. Their royalties, generally speaking, is 10 to 15% of every sale. So if it's $500,000, if a CD in that era cost $15 or $16, $5 or $6 would come off the top to the retailer. So that leaves $10 on what royalties are based on. If it's 10% royalties that they're earning a dollar off the sale of every CD sold. So when they sell a CD, they receive a dollar. That dollar needs to go back to the record label to pay for the advance. So what they need to sell in order to ever make any money off of the sale of an album is they need to sell 500,000 albums. That's $500,000. So they don't, after they sell 500,001 albums, they finally earn a dollar. Now, the trick of this is that in the United States, the Recording Industry Association of America considers a gold album when an artist has sold 500,000 copies of an album. So they have to go gold to even break even.
The really obvious question is, why do they do it? And that is very much, you know, the kind of what the book is about. It's a sort of terrifying hurdle, isn't it? You know, to be presented with, if you want to be, you know, successful in financial terms from your creative labor, you need to be essentially, you know, kind of breaking some significant records. And one of the things the book does is introduce this idea of a kind of like ideology of getting signed as a way of, I suppose, accounting for some of the reasons why musicians and actually, yeah, you know, as kind of gig economy laborers are still getting involved in these contractual relations. So what is this kind of ideology of getting signed, and how does it help us kind of understand why musicians get involved with these kind of contracts?
Well, when I first started research on the book, what I wanted to understand was that first question you asked, why do people want to sign a record contract if it's so inequitable? And I ended up with researching the ideology of getting signed, because I was more interested in not only why they do it, but what kind of where the motivation comes from and where it exists in society. So I coined this phrase, ideology of getting signed, to speak to Marx and his conceptions of ideology, and to think in terms of how ideology ends up motivating people to do the thing that enables capitalism to keep chugging along. So in terms of the ideology of getting signed, it's this dream that exists throughout society, not just with musicians, but with their friends and family, that signing a record contract means that somebody made it. They're not just playing music and getting together with some friends and going and playing at a bar and calling themselves a musician, which are kind of folk devils of society in their own way. But they've really made it at the point when they've signed a record contract. And so that ideology kind of is the grease that keeps the wheels turning.
Within that, you sort of gesture towards this, that the way that, you know, it takes a lot of material relations for ideology to function, really. And the book, actually, I should say, the book is filled with quite a lot of ethnographic material. You know, you as participant, you talking to musicians, in some ways trying to make it big in your own kind of way. But actually, at the same time, the book has got quite a lot of theoretical interventions, and you know, you flagged a couple of them quite usefully there. And one way is probably to go back to something you'd said around record contracts, is to think about copyright. And, you know, immediately sort of copyright sounds, well, you know, this is kind of boring, it's sort of legal, but actually it's one of the kind of key ways that the ideology of getting signed functions, particularly in terms of both, I guess, kind of closing off ownership of the labor of musicians, but also as being part of the way that musicians end up kind of alienated from their own work. So I wonder if you could kind of explain copyright's role in the ideology of getting signed.
Yeah, I think that copyright is kind of the original sin, if you will, of the music industry. So copyright, going back to, I believe, the Statute of Anne in England, was always about protecting publishers, or at least initially protecting printers. They're going to print books. So in the act of printing a book, they want to make sure that somebody else doesn't come along and start printing the same book and selling the copies. So they negotiated and came up with this idea of copyright. And copyright was never there to protect the author in the way that we think about it today as protecting the author. And again, this is an ideological standpoint that somehow the author is being protected. But what copyright does is it ends up creating this package of rights. We call it property rights. And in a way, as I outline in the book, it's a useful way to think about how copyright operates in capitalism. But it's not a property right. If somebody can't steal your copyright the way somebody could steal a phone or something, the copyright is always there, and it's this package. But within music, and I try to think about it in terms of how it motivates people to work for capital. And I draw back in the chapter 3 of the book to land enclosure and the land enclosure acts in Britain and early capitalism, 15th, 16th centuries, where peasants working on the land for feudal lords, right, that you worked on the land and you paid, you gave a percentage of the stuff that you grew to the lord, and you kept the rest for yourself. But it was always that percentage that you had to give, and they didn't own the land. They were tenants, right? So when capitalism, the process that Marx describes is when capitalism started getting churning, the land enclosure and the creation of private property made it so these serfs either could continue to work on the land as wage labor, or they had to get off the land and go somewhere. And they were sent into cities. I can't remember what king it was, but killed an amazing, maybe you remember better than I do. I think it was like 50,000 vagabonds in 1 year, which is an incredible amount of the English population of the time. And this created capitalism because these people had to go find a job and had to work as wage labor. And copyright does something very similar. Now, granted, vagabonds aren't being loaded up and killed. But the way I tried to think through this was musicians own the means of production. It's not very expensive to get an instrument. They make pretty cheap guitars and drum sets today, but even kind of more expensive expensive instruments are not always a barrier to being able to play music. You can borrow someone's instrument. You can find a used one. You can have one handed down to you. People have instruments. So there's no real way for capital to get involved in the process as long as musicians own instruments. So they created this copyright as a way to enclose particular property rights and for capital to get involved in the process. And in doing so, they this all happens with the phonograph and early recording equipment, and to say, well, if you want to put this thing out there, you need our support. So you have to give those rights up to the record label. And so that's where I see copyright come in.
I mean, there's loads of big ideas in the book. I was going to say like the other big idea, but there are actually loads of big ideas in the book. But one of the other big ideas in the book is I guess, a kind of social critique of the US as a society, which I mean, it picks up on both, you know, kind of enclosure and copyright and ideas about things like alienation as well. But you chart a system where the ideology of getting signed basically means that musicians are always kind of competing against each other. And actually, like later on in the book, you give quite a detailed breakdown of how even things like, you know, kind of battle of the bands, are, you know, really sort of negative in terms of fostering this sense of competition. But this isn't just a kind of a music industry thing. And again, this is one of those elements where the book is speaking way beyond just the music industry. I guess you're offering a critique of contemporary or maybe actually historical US society. And this idea of competition is the crucial thing. So what's going on there? What's the kind of the nature of and the problem with competition?
American capitalism is shot through with the idea of kill or be killed in business. And in music, you see this from the very start. So I recall being, you know, as early as fifth grade when I started playing music, you do these things called chair tests. And while in the United States, we have laws about posting students' grades, for instance, I mean, technically you could post a grade, but you have to assign somebody an anonymous number so that other people can't see. So you could have competition in that way. But, you know, as soon as you start playing music, everything comes down to are you first chair, second chair, third chair, fourth chair on your instrument in school band? And everybody knows who's first chair, second chair, third chair, etc. Right. So it creates this sense of competition, no different than, say, sporting events. And I think that, you know, the concept of playing in music should all really be about teamwork. But instead of being about creating the best music possible with the people around you, it becomes, well, how do I get ahead of this person? And that remains the case throughout music when it comes to an instrument. So you have auditions. Auditions are very public in a way that an interview is not. If you go for an interview, there you might never see the other people that are interviewing, but in music and arts generally, in the performing arts, you might be sitting in the room watching other people audition. You might be sitting in the waiting room having to talk to the other people that are auditioning and being able to hear them from the next room. So that idea, that tension is always there. It remains even if you're in a band. You might very well be competing with the people in your band to get a better gig. And to continue that kind of trajectory back to school bands, you go and you go to competitions like a sporting event. In the United States, and I talk about some of the long history of this going back in the first competitions that arise. But when I was in high school or in middle school, we'd go on band trips and compete in these things. They were for-profit competitions that you would go and to a city and go to amusement parks as part of it. It was this whole package deal of travel. But then there were also kind of the regional band district band competitions. So which band was the best? Or you have marching bands. My middle school band director just contacted me last night. He was the drummer for the Isley Brothers. His name's Everett Collins. But he would take us I grew up in Virginia, and we would go up to New York where he grew up, and fire departments have these really crazy competitions in New York over the summer into the fall, where they have these marching competitions, and we played in North Amityville. You may have heard of seen the movie Amityville Horror. That's where he was from. So we'd go up there and had a drum corps called Drummers with Attitudes, playing on NWA, DW. And so we played, and it was like, we were completely different because we played funk, but you were competition. It was a competition against other marching bands. But he contacted us because he wants to go. He lives in Atlanta now, and he wants to have like a big get together and march in the Martin Luther King Jr. Day parade next year. So that's kind of on the top of my mind. But this competition goes on. It ends up in Battle of the Bands, but it really highlights itself in record contracts. And that's the thing that people compete for. And it's really, you're competing for the opportunity to be exploited by capital.
Should we talk about some music? Like, everything we've been talking about, I think, is, you know, kind of crucial in understanding how both the contract and music industry and, you know, as you mentioned, US society functions. But obviously, you know, the book, I keep coming back to this, has got all of this really rich detail about actual, you know, musicians and their working lives. And maybe we'll do two. Talked about competition, you know, possibly kind of being in competition with your own bandmates, certainly with other artists. But actually, there's a kind of a weirdness about the kind of solidarity of being in a band. This band Solace was one of your case studies, who I guess American listeners would be familiar with them if they're into, you know, kind of heavy music. I'm not sure whether kind of outside of my, you know, sort of hipster, sort of heavy alternative music communities, other listeners would know them. But I think they're quite a nice case study in that.
Solace is actually a pseudonym. So there's no band named Solace.
Oh, I thought they were the spin-off from Godspeed. I'm slightly disappointed. I was like, wow, you met like Godspeed.
No, they were. I hope I didn't use somebody's an actual band name. The band name is similar to the word Solace. And they are a kind of folk band.
That's really interesting. I thought they were much more kind of both famous and real. What's going on with them? What was the kind of the sort of tensions of being in a band, working in a band?
So I met with them. They were playing a gig. It was at an amphitheater, and it was a pretty good sized gig. And they were from one city, and they moved to Nashville, Tennessee to try to make it. And they were in this town that I was in, and I'm hanging out backstage with these guys, and they're kind of telling me about their trials and tribulations of moving from one small college music town to Nashville and what that meant for them. And in that move, that a couple people in the band did not make the move with them. So they got some other people from small college music town to move to Nashville with them. Kind of over time, I think they'd ended up with somebody who was not from small college music town, but they met them in Nashville to replace someone. But there were machinations going on to try to really establish themselves as a good band. And there were, I think, three people at that point who were still part of that original core. It was a five-piece band. So they were clearly trying to get somewhere. But the one person who had become part of their band since being in Nashville, his part of the story was always a little bit different from what they were saying. So they were really trying to make it as a band. And it was also clear that he was trying to make it as a musician. And this band was an opportunity for him. So there were very interesting dynamics going on with them. I go to write the book and notice maybe, I don't know if this was 6-9 months after I had spoken with them, they were no longer playing. And then a couple months later, you know, I'm still working on the book and I see that they're together for a kind of reunion gig somewhere as I'm looking on the internet. So they kind of follow this trajectory of a band trying to make it and then not making it. And in our conversation, I was like, well, you know, would you ever want to get signed to a record label? And they kind of tell me this long story about how they had just been in negotiations with a record label. It seemed like a smaller independent label in Nashville. And they kind of laughed the contract out of the door because they didn't like what the label was trying to sell them, which is also another interesting tension among bands, is that when musicians are young and they're kind of naive getting started and they don't know what these contracts look like, they're very eager to sign whatever comes their way. But as musicians play more and they know more about how the industry operates, they're not as eager to sign whatever comes their way. They are aware of how exploitative the terms are. So they're willing to give up the dream of signing a contract if the contract's not what they want. And that was the case with Solace.
At like is it the opposite end of the music industry? Like, or the kind of like, I suppose the end of the music industry that everybody in, say, yeah, the folk world or the rock world is really kind of, you know, dismissive of and you know, thinks is the kind of, you know, the problem maybe is the kind of TV talent show version of the record industry. And actually thinking about Methods was that interesting because you talk a bit in the book about how, you know, doing field work around this TV show, The Voice, which it is basically like, I mean, that's been sold all over the world. And there's, you know, kind of loads of countries that have got their own version of The Voice now, how, you know, doing field work was tricky and, you know, kind of naming people and even, you know, kind of getting access was, you know, sort of slightly delicate, at least compared to sort of, you know, hanging out in various music scenes. But one of the things you do in the book is like, you don't just kind of do the usual, you know, TV talent shows are awful. I mean, they are, you know, bad, but like, you know, it's not just the kind of a classic sort of critique. What one of the things you try and do is say, well, actually, we should read TV talent shows through record contracts. And, you know, obviously it's, you know, the kind of the ultimate version of getting signed, but also it tells us something quite unusual about how record contracts work.
Yeah, and The Voice wasn't something that I thought that I would be talking much about when I started the book. I have friends that have auditioned for different talent shows, not The Voice, because when I was active as a musician, it was before The Voice was around. But I do have two friends that auditioned for American Idol. And so I had kind of an understanding of how this operates. You know, Idol as a brand, these are all brands and yeah, they operate in different countries. Idol, of course, starting first in Britain. But The Voice, it just kept coming up. I mean, I was hanging out at a bar and I was there trying to talk to different musicians. There was a, it was a kind of music meetup, and I'm hanging out, and the person I was talking to was like, "Oh, you need to talk to this guy over here. Let me introduce you. He was on The Voice." And so I start talking to him and his manager, and they tell me all this stuff about contracts and about how messed up the Voice is. And I'm like, wow, that's really fascinating. So then I wanted to interview people at the auditions, and it came to my hometown. So Arlington, Texas is the place kind of in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, which is the third largest metroplex in the United States. Arlington's where all the stadiums are. So we have AT&T Stadium, which is where the Dallas Cowboys play. And we have Globe Life Park and Globe Life Field, and a new version, which is where the Texas Rangers, the baseball team, plays. And the auditions for The Voice were happening at the Rangers ballpark. So I was like, oh, cool. I want to go check this out. See if I can't just get in there and see how it happens. Right. And I had no real intention. But I kept trying to contact The Voice, and they wouldn't allow me. They would, number one, I had a hard time getting anybody to respond to me. And this is always, and I'm sure you've run into this problem as well, when you study the creative industries, the large creative industry corporations don't really want to talk to you. So record labels never want to speak with me. I try contacting The Voice in every way that I can think possible. I'm getting nowhere. Finally, I contact like the marketing department or the PR department that sets things up with journalists. And they, a couple days before the audition, contact me back and say, oh, hey, no, we're not going to give you press credentials. And I wasn't asking for press credentials. I'm not press. That would be weird. But they said, no, it's not going to happen. So I figured, oh, whatever, I'll just go down to the ballpark and talk to people. I mean, there's thousands of people that are going to show up. There's going to be people hanging out. So I show up, and I interviewed family members that are hanging out in the park across the street. And it really kind of told me a lot about the hopes and dreams that people had trying to audition on this show. But it also, throughout the whole ethnography, I started finding bits of information about The Voice and their kind of draconian laws that are contracts that they had people sign, and non-disclosure agreements. And those non-disclosure agreements make it so everything becomes hidden on the show. So people want to go on the show now to try to skip the bar circuit, if you will. And SoundCloud works the same kind of way. People don't necessarily need to go play at bars and demonstrate an up and coming musician. Now they can go on The Voice, or they can produce music and put it on SoundCloud and try to demonstrate that they have a following. The problem with The Voice is they perpetuate this dream that you're going to get on there. The prize in the U.S. on The Voice is $100,000 and a record contract. But nobody that I'm aware of up to this point has really even made it in music getting a record contract through The Voice. What tends to happen is people go on the show. It's got entertainment value, and the coaches on the show really benefit from the added publicity. But the singers that have their hopes and dreams for going on the show really are just crushed and end up with nothing after the fact. And it's highly exploitative, as I discuss in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I was brought to mind, you know, it made Simon Cowell like a, you know, internationally famous global superstar. But, you know, then, you know, it's tricky to kind of think of the key musicians who've come from that system and have had, you know, really sort of long term, you know, 10, 15 year careers. And it's funny you mentioned SoundCloud as, you know, another route. I mean, the book tries to engage with questions of the impact of digital a bit as well. And, you know, there's loads and loads of stuff going on in the book that I know you've been getting into with a related book and a related kind of research project. But I want to make sure we conclude with one of the most kind of interesting moments in the book, which was basically a kind of like, so what should we do about this? And I was really, really taken by, it might be like even the very sort of last page or, you know, certainly the last couple of pages of the book, where you talk about this idea about why do we think about musicians as being, having, you know, salaried employee status? And obviously the US has got unique kind of issues around things like access to healthcare through employers and that, you know, dynamic is important over there. But I was really intrigued by the way that almost like the opposite of the ideological construction of what it is to be a musician, what it is to be in a band, what it is to be a gig worker would be a solution to some of these problems. You know, almost the kind of like, let's make musicians the man and give them, you know, salaried employee status. So I was sort of intrigued by that and it really appealed to me. I'd love to know how you kind of think through that as a solution to the ideology of getting signed.
Well, I'd hardly say that they'd be the man for working for a salary, but they would certainly be working for the man, and they're already working for the man, and that's, I think, the crux of it. And there's some problems in the entertainment industries more generally. In Hollywood studios, they fought against having to be kind of this person that's forced to work for the studio. So there are kind of multiple lineages here, but as I argue throughout the book, these people are workers. They're just not considered workers. And by not being considered workers, they don't get protected by labor laws. They don't get a salary. They don't get a wage. They don't get labor protections for in the U.S. 40-hour work weeks. Like, these are not things that are attainable to musicians, but pretty much everybody else at the record label works for the record label. So if you ever go to one of these labels, you walk in, they're big shiny foyers that you walk into, and there's a receptionist sitting at a desk. That receptionist is a salaried worker. You might see a janitor come by and mopping the shiny floors, right? That janitor works for the record label. Everyone on up works for the record label. And as I argue, musicians are the workers that create value for record companies. And they're the only people at record companies that don't get paid a wage. So there's this tension there. And I think that a lot of it would be resolved if people were employed as salary workers. You sign a labor contract the same way you would sign any other labor contract. You would not be an independent contractor. And your job would be to work for the company and do a good job for them. And as long as you do a good job, your contract continues in the same way as any other labor contract. And maybe your music's not selling, so maybe you work into a different part of the company the way you would, you get a promotion or something. So you're no longer the frontline worker, you're working in A&R or something, but which is artist and repertoire where they sign people. So that's my big dream of how this could operate, though I also am not naive and I know that it's not going to work that way. And there's a lot of other ways that it could operate as well.
Is that stuff you're going to be thinking about in future projects? I know you've got another book out on streaming culture and the kind of you know, impact of things like streaming platforms, but also, you know, kind of digital more generally on culture. So are you going to be doing more kind of digital stuff? Are you going to be thinking about what would we call it, like business models for creative industries? Are you going to do more of the kind of general social critical stuff? You know, we've mentioned the gig economy quite a few times. What sort of comes next for your work?
So I think I'm working on some articles and chapters right now, but my next real big project is I'm beginning an ethnography of drummers. And I want to think in terms of the concept of rhythm and how rhythm works in society more generally. So Henri Lefebvre came up with rhythm analysis, and I want to try to think in terms of how rhythm operates in society, but thinking as a drummer and thinking how drummers think in those terms. So my next gambit's to go deeply theoretical on rhythm.